Romans 8, verse 26. We're going to be focusing in today on Romans 8, verse 28. Beginning to look at this verse, we'll try to look at part of it today and then probably finish it next Sunday. Likewise, the Spirit also helpeth our infirmities. For we know not what we should pray for as we ought, but the Spirit Himself maketh intercession for the saints, for us, with groanings which cannot be uttered. And He that searcheth the hearts knoweth what is the mind of the Spirit, because He maketh intercession for the saints according to the will of God. Now, verse 28. And we know that all things work together for good to them that love God, to them who are the called according to His purpose. For whom He did foreknow, He also did predestinate to be conformed to the image of His Son, that He might be the firstborn among many brethren. I'm going to read verse 28 and 29 again. And we know that all things work together for good to them that love God, to them who are the called according to His purpose. For whom He did foreknow, He also did predestinate to be conformed to the image of His Son, that He might be the firstborn among many brethren. What a wonderful, wonderful truths that are packed into those two verses. When I was a young child, I was a huge Memphis Tigers basketball fan. And my favorite player growing up was a guy named Elliott Perry. Everybody in Memphis fell in love with Elliott Perry. He was short. He was extremely skinny. He wore these big goggles that made his eyes just bulge out. He could shoot from anywhere on the court. He was fast as a deer. He was clutch. He was everything that you would want in a player, including the fact that he was soft-spoken and humble. He was not arrogant. And everybody fell in love with Elliott Perry. He wore these socks that came up to his knees and these big knee pads. He just looked like he was just goofy looking. But he was a great, great basketball player. And somewhere near the midway through his career there at Memphis, he just stopped making shots. He could not throw the ball in the hoop from anywhere on the court. And it became a big deal in the city. What's wrong with Elliott Perry? For about five or six games, it was like that. He could not make anything on the court anywhere. And it was obvious he was becoming very frustrated, and everybody was worried about this terrible situation. And then one game, he just started making everything again. It just started going in from everywhere. And we were excited about what's happened here. And somewhere during the game, he was shooting free throws. And the camera zoomed in on his knee pads. And on his knee pads, he had scribbled this phrase. Confidence is the key. Confidence is the key. Now, that's not any real deep thought, is it? But it had a lot of meaning for him. See, he had made thousands and thousands and thousands of shots and thousands of hours of practice on the court. He knew that he knew how to make baskets. But the problem was that after he had missed a few shots and had gone for a few games, he had completely lost his confidence. So he scrawled, "Confidence is the key," on his knee pads so he could remind himself whenever he looked down, "Just be confident. You can do this." And you know what? His slump was over. And so for the rest of his career, he wore that knee pad. Confidence is the key. And us, as little children playing in games in our little leagues, we all scrawled on our shoes and our socks, "Confidence is the key." And we were much better players for having scrawled that on our shoes and socks. Now, that's kind of a funny story, and yet it made a huge difference in his basketball ability. We see in this passage that we just read, confidence. We see a lack of confidence, and then we see confidence. In verse 26, we see a huge lack of confidence, don't we? What does it say? It says, we know not what to pray for as we ought. We don't know what to pray for. And that bothers us, doesn't it? Because what is it that we're praying for? We're looking to the future, aren't we? And we don't know what the future holds. And that can be worrisome, can't it? I've told you before, I'll tell you again, I am already praying for the first time that Sophia drives our car without me. That's just a big hang-up in my mind. Am I going to let her actually drive away from the house and go to the store? And I'll be praying at that moment, I guarantee you. But I'll tell you, I'm not going to know exactly what to pray for, am I? Will she remember that the brake is on the left and the gas pedal is on the right? Will she remember to look both ways three times before turning? Will she use her turn signal? Will there be somebody driving by that's reckless, not paying attention? Those thoughts will come into my mind. And I'll be praying. But I won't know exactly what to pray for because I won't know exactly what she will face. And there will be some nervous moments, I am sure. We know not what the future will hold, do we? And that is worrisome. That is bothersome to anybody who cares about their life, who cares about their family, who cares about the future. We know not. There's a lack of confidence. And yet there's a stunning change just two verses later, isn't there? This is the verse we're looking at today, verse 28. We don't know in verse 26 because of the future. Then what does verse 28 say? Verse 28 says, and we know. A word of confidence. A word of certainty. A word of peace. We know. We know. How many things in your life can you say, I know this? Can you say, you that work, I know I will get a paycheck in the next 2 weeks? Can you say that with certainty? You can say, I think I can. I think I will. I've always gotten one so far. This company seems to be in good shape. I think my boss seems to be happy with me. I'm pretty certain I'm going to get a paycheck in the next 2 weeks. But can you say, I know I will? Not in this day and age, can you? When companies go upside down before you would ever guess, when you people are getting laid off in stunning numbers, you can't say that with certainty, can you? I know I will get a paycheck. Take that thought through every other sphere of life. I know that I will work tomorrow. Do you know that? No, you don't. You don't know if you'll breathe tomorrow, right? So there's not many things in life that you can say, I know this. I'm sure of this. Yet what he says here is in regards to the future, isn't it? And we know. We're certain. We're sure of this. Let me ask you, can you say this with Paul? And we know that all things, that encompasses a lot, doesn't it? All is a pretty small word. It has a pretty big meaning, doesn't it? And we know that all things work together for good. That's a pretty big statement, isn't it? I don't know what the future holds. We already said that. We would be praying. We don't know. And yet we can still say we know that all things are going to work together for good. What is it? What is it that makes this big difference in a severe lack of confidence and then full confidence? There's a lot of similarities in these two thoughts. In prayer, we're praying about the future, aren't we? Aren't we? That's what we're praying about. Lord, give us this bread for today. Lord, give me strength for today. As all prayers are about the future. You don't pray for the past, do you? You pray for the future. And you don't know what the future's going to hold. And so both of these are about the future. And we know that all things will work out. It's about the future also, isn't it? So there's similarities there. That's not the difference. What is the difference? You know, it's a pretty ugly statement to make, isn't it? All things are going to work out for good. If you don't have a certain surety of that, do you? Is it? It's kind of an ugly statement. It's a meaningless statement. It's a trite statement. You ever had anybody tell you that? You're having a bad day, a really bad day. You can't see your way through the problem of the day. And somebody says, oh, it's all going to work out. And you want to turn around and slap them right square in the face, don't you? Do you think, how in the world do you know that this problem is going to work out? You don't know that. So what gives us this confidence? What makes us be able to say, yes, we do know that all things work together for good? Well, the answer, of course, is not in the future because we don't know the future. The answer, of course, is not in us because we don't even know what to pray for, much less we know what the future will hold. The answer, of course, in this extreme shift of confidence is found in God. It's the only place that it can be found in. When I think about myself and my knowledge of the future and my capacity to be able to handle the future, of which I don't even know what's going to happen in the future, that's a moment of great impotence, isn't it? Of great weakness. As I said a minute ago, it can be of great fear. What will she remember? Will she remember to hit the brake when it's time to hit the brake? I don't know. And so I have to point, to turn and point my direction, my focus to God. And the reason this statement is not a trite statement, the reason it's not a cruel statement, the reason it's not a meaningless statement or even a harmful statement, the reason that this is a statement of ultimate comfort and assurance and confidence is because this statement does not point to me, does not point to the future, it points directly to God. When I think about God, confidence is there. Deuteronomy 32, listen to what it says about God. Deuteronomy 32. By the way, it is important to focus, to consider the future. We don't know much about the future, but we do know one certainty. We do know that we will all die, don't we? Unless the Lord returns before we take our last breath, we know that everyone in this room, including myself, we are all going to die. From the moment we're born, we begin to die. From the moment we're born, we have one less day than we had the day before, right? We're all going to die. So it's important for us all to consider the future, at least to some degree. Now, when you consider the future, can you say, I know that it's all going to work out for good. It's all going to be fine. I will tell you, you cannot make that statement divorced from God. You cannot say, I know it's going to work out for good, divorced from the concept of God and God in your life. What does it say about God in Deuteronomy 32? Give ear, O heavens, verse 1, and I will speak, and hear, O earth, the words of my mouth. My doctrine shall drop as the rain, my speech shall distill as the dew, as the small rain upon the tender herb, and as the showers upon the grass. He says, what I'm about to say is going to drop like rain. You know how refreshing that rain is? How refreshing that dew is when we see the green grass start to come out this spring. We see the flowers start to bud as the rain comes and nourishes the ground. He says, this that I'm about to tell you is just like rain that nourishes the ground. Because I will publish the name of the Lord. Ascribe ye greatness unto our God. He says, the doctrine I speak, the words that I speak, are going to be as nourishing as the rain upon the ground in the springtime. I'm going to tell you about God. I'm going to tell you about the greatness of God. And here's what he says. He is the rock. His work is perfect. All his ways are judgment. A God of truth and without iniquity, just and right is he. Do you see how that begins to instill confidence in your heart? Compare these words that it says about God to what you can say about yourself. He is the rock. He's a rock. That's something that is certain, that is sure, that is firm. That lasts, right? Now, what about yourself? Are you a rock? Are you a rock? Are you certain? You may think that you are, and then the frailty of life, the aches and the pains start to come. You realize, I'm getting older. I'm not as strong as I used to be. I don't have the same recall I used to have. I'm getting weaker and weaker and weaker. I am not what I thought I was. I'm not really a rock, but he's a rock. His work is perfect, is what it says next. What about yours? Yes, you may try hard and you may use your mind and your talents to the best of your abilities, but let me ask you, is your work perfect? Perfect. Can't say that, can we? All His ways are judgment. They're all thought through. They're all discerning. He is a God of truth and without iniquity. Just and right is He. Do you see, friends, why He would point our focus to God as a place of confidence? He would point us to God as a place of assurance. He's a rock. He's truth. He has no iniquity. He does nothing wrong. His work is perfect. A God of truth and without iniquity, just and right is He. In Romans 11, it says this about God. Romans 11. verse 33 through 36. Oh, the depth, how deep of the riches. He's got a lot of riches. Oh, the depth of the riches, both of the wisdom and knowledge of God. How unsearchable are His judgments and His ways past finding out. For who hath known the mind of the Lord? Or who hath been His counselor? Who gave God counsel and how to do things? No one. Or who hath first given to Him, and it shall be recompensed unto Him again? For of Him and through Him and to Him are all things, to whom be glory forever. You see, friends, we don't look at life through the hopeless lens of our weakness or our uncertainties or even the future as we would hold it in our own strength and our own willpower. We look at life instead by looking at it from the lens of the glory of God. What does it say about God? It says He has all the wisdom in the world. Oh, the depth of the wisdom of God. Oh, the depth of the knowledge of God. Oh, the depth of the judgments of God. Oh, the depth of the ways of God. And it says of God, He doesn't need anybody to give Him a counsel because He already knows it all already. So it says, of Him and through Him and to Him are all things, to whom be glory forever. We must look at life through the lens of the glory of God being involved in our lives. The glory of God. We ascribe God glory. We say God is glorious based on His worth. We also, because we are the recipients of this wisdom. Let me ask you, how do you know that God's wise? Well, you know that God's wise because of He said it in His Word, right? But you also know that God is wise because of how He's dealt wisely in your life, right? How do you know that God has knowledge, a great depth of knowledge? Well, you know because it says it in His Word, but you also know because of the way that He knows you and that He's probed you and that He's tried you and that He's purged you, and you know that God knows me more than better than myself, right? How do you know that God's way is perfect? How do you know that He's a rock? Because you have fallen in times past and you've crumbled and you've knelt and you've clung to Him and He's held you and He's kept you and He's preserved you from falling, right? So you know that He's a rock. You know it by personal experience with Him, right? And so we look at life saying, yes, I don't know the future, but I do know God. I know God. And He's perfect. And He's a rock. And He's wise. And He's got all knowledge. And He is sovereign over all. So the reason we can say we have confidence concerning the future is because we know the future is held by God. Now, so we say God is the one who gives us this confidence. We know that all things work together for good. God is the one who gives us this confidence. But what is it about God? What is it about God that can assure my heart that all things will work together for good? Now, next Sunday, we're going to talk about some of the things that work together for good. And we're going to talk about what good is. But today, let's just take the phrase on its own merit. All things work together for good. What is it about God that gives me this confidence? Do you have this confidence this morning? Do you believe the future for you will be good? Now, I don't mean it will be without trials. And I don't mean that it will be without heartache. And I don't mean that it will be without pain and without tears and without suffering, but I mean that it will ultimately be good, work together for good in your life. Do you believe that? Do you believe that? Well, what is it about God that gives you that belief? What is it about God that gives you that confidence? We find this confidence, or this part of God that gives us this confidence here in verse 28. And we know that all things work together for good to them that love God, to them who are the called according to His purpose. There is a word there in that verse that talks about God that is the key word that gives us this assurance, this trust, this confidence in God. And that word is purpose. Purpose. What an important word. Purpose. What does it mean? It means that God is a God of purpose. God is a God who plans. God is a God who thinks things through before He does. Who thinks things through before they happen. God is a God of purpose. So let's look at this purpose in Ephesians chapter 1. God is a God of purpose. What does it mean that God is a God of purpose? Well, let's see what it means. Ephesians 1. Ephesians 1. We'll read verses 9 through 11. He says in let's read verse 8 also. Wherein He hath abounded toward us in all wisdom and prudence. God has dealt with me in wisdom in a wise way, having made known unto us the mystery of His will, according to His good pleasure, which He hath purposed in Himself, that in the dispensation of the fullness of times He might gather together in one all things in Christ, both which are in heaven and which are on earth, even in Him, in whom also we have obtained an inheritance, being predestinated according to the purpose of Him who worketh all things after the counsel of His own will. There's all sorts of words in these few verses that talk about a God who thinks, a God who plans, a God who's a God of purpose. The first word is let's just look at these words. He has purposed in Himself in verse 9. Verse 11 says that He has predestinated. And also says that He has worked after the counsel of His own will. So there's a counsel, there's a thought, there's planning, there's purpose. And then it says He worketh all things after the counsel of His own will. What does that tell us? It tells that God's planning or His purpose encompasses everything. Right? God's purposes, His planning, His thoughts, His counsel encompass all things. He worketh all things after the counsel of His own will. Now, if God works all things, if He's a God whose purpose encompasses everything, that must include me, right? Right? So God's a God of purpose. He plans. He thinks. He has a counsel, and He works according to this counsel, and this counsel, this purpose, encompasses all things. And if it encompasses all things, then therefore it must include me. It includes big things, it includes small things. It includes significant things in our eyes, and it includes insignificant things in our eyes. It includes kings, it includes paupers, it includes lords, it includes servants, it includes celebrities, it includes nobodies, okay? He has a plan. He has a purpose in life. And He therefore has a purpose in my life. Now, if you doubt that God's purpose could include small things, that God's plan could include small things, let me just have you read Matthew chapter 10, verse 29. In Matthew 10, what is happening here is Christ is preparing His disciples to go and be the evangelist that He has prepared them to be, to go and preach the gospel to people who do not want to hear it. Now, friends, it's a blessing to preach to people who want to hear me preach. But sometimes I say things that you don't want to hear, and it makes me sweat a little bit, okay? But I've got to do it anyway. I've got to be faithful. But for the majority of the time, I'm preaching to people things that they want to hear. So I've got a pretty easy job. But let me tell you, friends, the job that these guys had was a far different job. They would continually preach to people who did not want to hear what they had to say. Because what they had to say were words of condemnation against their lifestyles. Words of condemnation against their salvation. Words of condemnation against their confidence and their arrogance. And they would come and they would preach and they would say, listen, you guys who think you're something are actually nothing. You need salvation, and it's found in Jesus Christ. Imagine having that job. You may not like your job. You may not love your job, but your job is not half as hard as these guys' job was. Because these guys would not just face people that didn't like them. They would face people who would try to kill them. And in fact, many of these people who sat under the audience, or under the word, the teaching of Christ right here, who were being prepared to go out, many of these people ended up dying as martyrs, dying as criminals for the simple crime of preaching about Jesus. Okay? So you can imagine there's a little nerves going on here. You can imagine there's a little bit of fear going on here. And what does Jesus say to them to calm their troubled hearts? Listen to what he says in verse 26. Fear them not, therefore, for there is nothing covered that shall not be revealed, and hid that shall not be known. What I tell you in darkness, that speak ye in light, and what you hear in the ear, that preach ye upon the house. He's saying, go and preach. And preach boldly. Don't hide this wonderful truth. And fear not them which kill the body. You may die for this, but are not able to kill the soul. All they can do, they can kill your body, they can't touch your soul. But rather fear him which is able to destroy both soul and body in hell. He says, listen, don't fear these people. Love them, preach to them, but don't be afraid of them. They may kill you. That's the worst they can do. Instead, fear God, who's able to destroy your soul and body in hell. But then he gives them these words of comfort. And what are they about? They're about the encompassing purpose of God. The encompassing hand of God. The encompassing counsel and thought of God. Now, what does he say? Are not two sparrows sold for a farthing? And one of them shall not fall on the ground without your Father. But the very hairs of your head are all numbered. What does he do? He takes them to the most seemingly insignificant thing in all the world, a sparrow. A sparrow is a bird. It's a very small bird, and clearly it didn't have much meat on it, because it was not very valuable. He says, listen, two sparrows are sold for a farthing. Children, a farthing was money. And I don't know the exact comparison level of a farthing to American money, but it's something like this. Four farthings equaled one penny. Okay? Four farthings equaled one penny. And one farthing could buy you two sparrows, okay? So a fourth of a penny. Can you think of anything in this world that costs a fourth of a penny? Can you think of anything that costs a penny? I can't, can I? Can you? You can go to the dollar store, and this stuff costs $3. So I don't have anything that costs a dollar, right? And he says, one fourth of a penny will buy you two sparrows. That's something pretty small, isn't it? I mean, pretty insignificant. But what does he say about the sparrows? He says, not one sparrow will fall to the ground without your Father. In other words, God knows, but he more than just knows. Can you imagine, children? God knows every sparrow that falls to the ground dead. But he more than just knows. Because this verse doesn't say, without your Father knowing about it. It's saying, without your Father, without your Father's permission, without your Father's plan, without your Father's counsel, without your Father's knowledge, not one sparrow will fall to the ground. And then he says this, Brother Chad, this won't mean much to you and me. He says, and the very hairs of your head are all numbered. But to some of the other people it means a lot, right? What's one hair? One of my children told me the other day that we lose 80 hairs a day. Is that right? Somebody told me that. I don't know. Somebody told me that. We lose about an average of 80 hairs a day. I don't know if that's true or not. I sure hope it's not. But still, I don't think, I don't worry, I don't pray, I don't go bury a single hair when it falls off to you. I don't even think about it.
He says, your Father has numbered every single one of your hairs. And not a sparrow falls to the ground without Him. Now friends, you can place your trust for the future in yourself if you want to. But let me tell you about you. You don't know what the future holds. You can't determine the future. You can't really plan your future even very well. And you sure can't face God the last day with your own strength and your own planning and your own willpower and your own righteousness. Romans, the power of Romans 8:28 is found in turning and trusting and laying a hold upon a God who has all things encompassed in His plan. Even the falling to the ground of a sparrow and the numbering of our hairs. So, what do you know about the purpose of God? It encompasses all things. He's got a plan and encompasses all things, big things, small things. That's a good thing, isn't it? Because we often live life without purpose. Let's look at one more thing regarding God's purpose. Isaiah chapter 46. Isaiah 46. Verse 9. Remember the former things of old. For I am God, and there is none else. I am God, and there is none like me. Declaring the end from the beginning, and from ancient times the things that are not yet done. That's the future, right? Declaring the end from the beginning. Did you hear that? He declared the end from the beginning. From ancient times, He declared the things that are not yet done. That's a God who plans, isn't it? It's a God of purpose. He's declared the happenings of the end from the very beginning. From the ancient times, from the time before the world was, He's declared the things that are not yet done. He gives an example right here in this same passage of doing that. He calls Cyrus, this ravenous bird from the east, he calls him Cyrus. This is about, I think it's about 400 years before Cyrus was ever born. And later on, he'll call Cyrus by name. Okay? He calls Cyrus by name. And Cyrus was the king of the Medes that God raised up to bring His people out of captivity. Israel was in captivity for 70 years under Babylonian rule. Look in your history books, this is what happened. For 70 years they were under Babylonian rule. And then God used Cyrus, did He not, to be the one who would bring them out of captivity and turn them back to their land under the time of Daniel, right? Now Cyrus has not yet been born yet. It's still a long way away. But not only has Cyrus not yet been born, but the Medes and the Persians were not even in power. The Babylonians were in power. The Medes and the Persians were an afterthought. But in this time, after God calls what's going to happen, the Medes and the Persians, it's not just the Bible, this is history. The Medes and the Persians come and they overthrow Babylon and they have Israel in the possession. And Cyrus dreams and he's used by God to turn Israel back to their land. That's pretty powerful, isn't it? It's a God of purpose, isn't it? From the ancient times, He has called forth the things that are not yet done. And then He says this, my counsel shall stand. I will do all my pleasure. I've seen children say that before. I am not going to bed. Well, after a good whooping, they go to bed, don't they? Anybody can say that, right? Anybody can say, I'm going to do what I want to do. Prove it. Prove it. You won't get very far. But God says, my counsel shall stand. I will do all my pleasure. What does this teach us about the purpose of God? It teaches us that God's purposes cannot be thwarted. You hear that? The purposes of God cannot be thwarted. They cannot be thwarted. Yes, friends, we can rebel against God. Yes, we rebel against God. But I'm telling you, what this is saying to us is that no one can stand before God and shake their fist against God and get their way against God ultimately. That's an important thought to understand.
A great example of this is, of course, Pharaoh. Romans chapter 9 talks about Pharaoh. Pharaoh is another man from history. He was the king of Egypt. And as the king of Egypt, he was a man of great wealth, a man of great power. Most of you probably know this story. This is another time that Israel found themselves under the rule of a difficult enemy. And under Pharaoh's rule, as you know, he turned the screws down, put the vice tighter on the people of Israel until it was almost unbearable. And it's one of the favorite stories of God's people. The children even love to sing about it. He's just the same today. When Moses and the Israelites from Egypt's land did flee, behind them were proud Pharaoh's host, and in front of them the sea. God raised the waters like a wall and opened up the way. And the God that lived in the olden times, He's what? He's just the same today. The story of Pharaoh and his ultimate demise is a story that is celebrated by God's people for generations and even celebrated today. Because what happened there? What happened there was that Pharaoh raised his fist and shook them against God. He said, Moses and Aaron came, and they were the men of God to lead the children of Israel away from the captivity. He said, Pharaoh, we want to leave. We want to leave. We're tired of this. We've been in your bondage. We're slaves to you. We were never meant to be slaves to you. We came in as free men. We were the friends of your father, your grandfather, and you now have turned us into slaves. We were not meant to be slaves. Let us go. Pharaoh says, you can't go. You remember what happens? God shows His power over all the world, not just the sparrow, but all of nature. And in succession, they had lice that came upon the land and swarmed the land. They had frogs that consumed the land. All the water in the land turned to blood. What are some of the more things? They had locusts that came upon them. I can't remember all. There were 10 plagues that came upon Egypt. And on every occasion, when the plague came and it was impossible, you couldn't find no water to drink, only blood to drink, what would Pharaoh do? Pharaoh would repent and say, fine, just tell your God, I know He's more powerful than me. If you just take this thing away, I promise you, I will let you go. And God would remove the plague. And Pharaoh would change his mind. He would shake his fist in the face of God and say, no, you're staying right here. You're mine. And another plague would come. And it would be repeated. The same thing would happen. And finally, as you probably know, finally on that last plague, it was the fiercest one of all. Because on that last day, that awful, awful, dark, terrible night of horrors, of screams that were heard throughout the whole land. Screams not of defiance, but screams of grief and sorrow as God sent His angel of death throughout all the land of Egypt and the firstborn child. Imagine this, children. In this congregation, imagine in each one of your families, your firstborn going away just like that, dead, gone just like that. And the horrors of the land just consumed the land that night. And Pharaoh was broken. And he said, let them go. His own son died. He said, let these people go. Get them out of my sight. And yet still, even with his own son dead and his kingdom desecrated, his people probably angry at him, still he raised back his fist up and he shook it in the face of God and he chased those people of Israel as they fled towards the sea. He chased them with his chariots. He chased them with his armies and he chased them with his swords. And he's going to bring them back to be under his hand by any means necessary. And you know what happened? The children of Israel were trapped at the face of the Red Sea. And they saw the host of Pharaoh coming behind them. And they saw the mountains on either side of them. And there was no place left for them to go. God says, my counsel shall stand. I will do all my pleasure. So what happened was something that has only happened one time since. The waters, We said they raised up like a wall. I don't know what happened exactly, but I know this. This big body of water was divided. And a place of dry ground was found that was sufficient for every one of these about million, maybe 2 million children of Israel to flee, to walk across the sea on dry ground. Have you seen how powerful
that water is in the last few days? As you've watched the news reports of the tsunamis in Japan, have you seen just how devastating, how powerful that water is? My friends, I want to tell you that water can't hold a candle to our God who says, "My counsel shall stand. I will do all my pleasure." The water stood still like a wall and did not move. That same "peace be still" water that allowed them to escape to perfect and full freedom was the same powerful force that came down upon Pharaoh as he chased them into the Red Sea, and it drowned every one of his army, every one of his horses, and it drowned Pharaoh himself. Perhaps as Pharaoh was taking that last breath before he went under, perhaps he could hear this. "For the Scripture saith unto Pharaoh, even for this same purpose." You see, friends, God is a God of purpose. God did not make Pharaoh. He did not make Pharaoh do those horrible things that he did. God does not cause sin. Pharaoh sinned on his own merit. But in the purpose of God, God allowed Pharaoh to rise to power, to rise to this height of arrogance. He allowed Pharaoh to do it because God had a higher purpose in Pharaoh's life. Let's hear what it says. "Even for this same purpose have I raised thee up, that I might show my power in thee, and that my name might be declared throughout all the earth." Throughout all the earth. Friends, the purposes of God cannot be successfully thwarted. You cannot shake your fist and say, "I will do it my way," in the face of God. God's counsel shall stand. Pharaoh rose to prominence, and Pharaoh drowned in the Red Sea because for this same purpose, God raised him up that not the power of Pharaoh might be seen, but the power of God might be seen, and that God's name, His power, might be declared throughout all the earth. What we learn about the purpose of God, we learn that God's purpose encompasses a lot of things, all things. We see that it includes things big and small that must include me. We see that it cannot be thwarted. Now, I'm not getting near as far as I thought I would get this morning, but it is so important that we understand this purpose, because the purpose of God is a foundation for us to be able to say all things work together for good. The purpose of God is the only thing that I know of that will allow me to get out of bed this morning and not be completely freaked out by all the craziness that is in the world today. As I raise children, I can only carry them so far. When I see the wickedness and the lewdness and the real fear and the economic uncertainty and the world uncertainty, there's only one thing that is a foundation, a bedrock to anchor and secure my soul, and that's found in the purpose of God. Purpose of God. Now, I want us to understand this purpose. I'm not sure how much farther to go because we got a long way to go in understanding the purpose of God. Let me just say a couple more things. So God's purpose can't be thwarted, right? And it encompasses all things. Now the question next is, what is the purpose of God, right? We said it's strong, it's powerful, it's big, but what is the purpose of God? What is God's plan? Does God have a plan? Yes, He has a plan. What is His plan? Well, God has one overarching purpose, okay? One main purpose, one main plan. And everything that happens, every other part of God's plans, the individual part, the specific parts for your life are found under this one big plan. What is that plan? Well, it's very simple. We said it many times. The plan of God, the overarching purpose of God, is to declare His glory. And His glory might be said. Did you just not read that in the last verse that we saw? Pharaoh, why did I raise you up? That I might declare my name and my power throughout all the earth. Okay? That's the plan of God, to declare His glory. His plan in dealing with humans is that His glory might be seen. His glory might shine brightly. His glory might be declared. That's exactly what Revelation 4:11 says. Thou art worthy. This is the creatures in heaven and the saints in heaven who sing this song before God continually. What do they sing? Thou art worthy, O Lord. Revelation 4:11. Thou art worthy, O Lord, to receive glory and honor and power. For thou hast created all things, and for thy pleasure. What is the pleasure of God? To declare his glory. For thy pleasure, they are and were created. You need to understand, friends, that God's got one thought in mind, and he is laser focused in on it. He's locked in on this one plan, this one purpose, and that his glory might be seen. Let me say something about that. Listen, if that's your first time hearing that that's God's plan, it may sound to you like God is a capricious God, right? It may sound to you like God is an arrogant God. It may sound to you like God is a God who's too full of himself. After all, do you like being around people who all they want to talk about is how good they are and how pretty they are and how smart they are and how successful they are? I hate it too. Okay? It's annoying to be around people that all they can do is talk about themselves, right? But I want to tell you something, friends. God is not like you. The reason that you're annoying when you tell me how great you are, the reason that I'm annoying when I tell you how smart I am, you know why it's annoying? Because I am nothing. I'm not that smart, and you're not that pretty. Okay? The reason that God's not annoying is because he is the only thing of value. He really is that smart. When we sing, oh, the depth of the riches of the wisdom of God, we're not saying anything that's wrong, or anything that's exactly right. He does have an unfathomable, unsearchable depth of riches of wisdom, of knowledge, and knowledge. He is the God whose counsel shall stand. I laugh when you tell me I'm going to do this and nothing can stop me. I laugh. I know a God who stops people. But when God says it, I go, wow. Imagine a creature, imagine a being who can do anything that he really wants to do. And not only can he do anything, he always uses that in a good way. He only does that which is good. Listen, if I was all that, I would be more like Solomon. I want to see how much more I could gather in, how much more I could do, how much smarter I could be, how much more glory I could heap upon myself. That's what I would be. And it would be disgusting, wouldn't it be vile, as Solomon was. But God has all this wisdom and all this knowledge and all this power at his beck and call, and he always uses it in a perfect way. That's incredible, isn't it? What a God. So friends, God's not capricious. And he's not arrogant. He's only saying what ought to be said. He, all glory, all excellence belongs to him. So we ought to ascribe greatness to God. That's God's great purpose. That's the purpose of God. And that's the reason we're going to see later. We can say this verse with confidence. Because God has a purpose that his glory might be declared. Now listen, friends. This purpose, this plan of God includes everybody. Whether you love God or whether you don't love God, his plan is to get glory for himself. Let me just tell you, it's a lot better when you love God. Did you hear what it said about Pharaoh again? For the scripture saith unto Pharaoh, even for this same purpose have I raised thee up, that I might show my power in thee, and that my name might be declared throughout all the earth. He says, Pharaoh, you will fight against me. You will struggle against me. You will try to bring me down. But Pharaoh, I'm going to tell you something. My name is going to be declared throughout all the earth. My glory shall be seen throughout all the earth. Even today in 2011 in Ripley, Mississippi, as we sit looking back on the pages of time, we see Pharaoh's fall. What do? We say, glory be to the name of God, right? Right? So even for those who love not God, if you don't love God today, God's going to get some glory. But it may be out of your downfall. Maybe out of bringing you down. It says in verse 22 of the same chapter, what if God, willing to show his wrath and to make his power known, endured with much long suffering the vessels of wrath fitted to destruction? God is willing to show his wrath. Wrath against what? Wrath against sin. Wrath against rebels. Wrath against those who will not have God. Who say, I don't need God. I can do life on my own. God said, I'm going to show my wrath in you. He said, how does the wrath of God show the glory of God? Oh, friends, the wrath of God shows the glory of God. Let me put it this way. Don't you get sick and tired of injustice? Doesn't it make you sick to see criminals skirt the law? Doesn't it? All of us get sick of seeing it, right? Don't you get sick of husbands being unfaithful to their wives and they seem to get away with it? Doesn't it make you sick in your stomach? You know, for a while we were all carried away with the sordid body tale of Tiger Woods, and he went down into this humble place and he was shamed, and he got up and he said all these great things about how he was going to be he's a different person and he'd done wrong, and then that's always a process, right? It's always just kind of a short time thing, and then you get back on your feet and you're okay again. Well, he's back on his feet now. Saw the news this week that he was on the late night television. He's able to joke about it now and laugh about it. It's past all the sordid part now. He can joke and laugh. You see, does it make you kind of sick in your stomach? You see, friends, God gets glory because God actually will do that which is right. When God's wrath is seen against sin in the last day, we'll see justice. We'll see justice finally meted out in the way that it always should have been done. We as humans don't mete out justice right, do we? Because we're not just ourselves. But God is just, and His wrath will be seen. And it'll be glorious to see God making things right and doing things the right way. You see, God's purpose will be seen also in the wicked, right? In Pharaoh, His glory is seen. In the last day when His wrath is poured out, His glory shall be seen. And then it says in Philippians 2, verse 9, let's read this. Philippians 2, verse 9 through 11, a passage you probably know well. Philippians 2, wherefore God also hath highly exalted Christ and given Him a name which is above every name. Listen to this. That at the name of Jesus, every knee should bow of things in heaven and things in earth and things under the earth, and that every tongue should confess. Now, did you hear anybody being left out there? Listen again. At the name of Jesus, every knee should bow of things in heaven and things in earth and things under the earth, and that every tongue. This is the promise of what's going to happen one day, friends. This shall occur one day. Every tongue should confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. Friends, God is determined to make His glory seen. The one who says, my counsel shall stand, says, at one day, every single knee is going to bow and every single tongue is going to confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. Why is He doing this? Why will He do that? To the glory of God the Father. You see the purpose there? I'm going to bring down every knee. Some will bow before me in praise and say, Lord, thank you for showing me myself. Thank you for showing me my sins. Thank you for arresting me and for waking me up and showing my depravity, showing my hopelessness outside of Jesus Christ. And Lord, thank you for the blood of Christ, which has cleansed every one of my sins, of which I can pay not one single one. And the knees will flop down and the tongues will just babble on with praise of God. But some friends who have shooken, as Pharaoh, who shook their fists in the face of God to their dying breath, you know what's going to happen to them? They're going to look down, they're going to look up from their position of having been finally vanquished, and they will say, I hate to say it, but He's God. He's God. And God will be glorified. That's the purpose of God. The purpose of God is to declare His glory. Now, we're out of time. But God, in Romans 8, tells us that His purpose is to declare His glory, yes. But there are objects of mercy that He delights in declaring His glory in. And the way that He does that, as we'll see, is by working all things for their good. And conforming them, and changing them, and molding them, and shaping them to the image of His own darling Son, Jesus Christ. May God bless you with these thoughts and my prayer.